This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. This week's episode is brought to you again by the Friends of the Magic Word. Those are the ones who financially help us with producing this podcast through their financial support, through ongoing pledges and regular donations. We thank each of those who have helped us financially, and we also thank you, the listener, for tuning in each week and listening to these podcasts. If you'd like to hear more information or to learn how that you could become a friend of the Magic Word, please go to themagicwordpodcast.com. There you will see a tab where you can learn more about it. This week, I'm going to be introducing someone who is a friend of mine that many of you know and have seen perhaps at conventions or may even own one or several of his books on your magic bookshelf. Steve Beam is the author of the Semi-Automatic Card Tricks series, and he just completed the 12th edition of that book. It seems to be just a never-dying kind of a thing. Way back when, and yesteryear, he also was the one who had produced and published and marketed The Trap Door, which was a regular series then as well. And just before they closed that up, I think I might have had a contribution in the last month or the month before. I think I had to something just kind of in one of the last of those, just kind of slid in before they shut the door on The Trap Door. But anyhow, he's a very funny guy, hilarious guy, and is very good at writing scripts based upon topical things that are happening when he's at a convention. Well, he's going to talk a little bit about that and about scripting and about his books and different things that are going on in his life now that he's retired and what he's doing in retirement as a magician then as well. So please welcome my guest this week, Mr. Steve Beam, here on The Magic Word. Today I have with me someone all the way from the East Coast, and actually the Southeast Coast. In South Columbia or South Carolina? Where are you exactly, Steve?
I'm in Cary, North Carolina, which is a
North Carolina.
North Carolina, yeah, which is a suburb of Raleigh.
Okay, and so with me again from North Carolina is someone who, if you attend the Fechter's Robies 4F, it used to be a lot longer title, that he is one of the hosts of the afternoon shows that we have, sometimes evening shows, I guess. Anyhow, he is also someone who some of you may not have seen at magic conventions because he is not someone who in the past has had the time necessarily to attend the conventions because he's been busy authoring a lot of books. In fact, he just released the 12th edition of Semi-Automatic Card Tricks. And so please welcome my friend, Mr. Steve Beam. Hey there, Steve.
Hi, Scott. Good to be with you.
It's good to have you here then as well. It's fantastic, and I'm so excited. This is number 12. I mean, it's kind of like the Rocky Balboa. Keep thinking, okay, there's going to be like number 50 coming or something.
Yeah, well, let's hope you don't believe that I should have stopped like Rocky did at 3.
Like he should have.
Like he should have, yeah.
It continues to get more stuff. Now, all of your things have been contributed by others. In other words, that all 13 volumes are not those that are your tricks. Would you say it's more like kind of like Apocalypse or Richard Kaufman's Almanac, in which that there might be something in which it'll be a trick, and then afterwards you say, well, here's something that's my take on an improvement or something?
No, I would say I haven't done the math on it, but I would expect probably about 60 to 70% of it's mine.
Is it?
Okay. And then the rest is contributors. But I have some terrific contributors, and that's what makes it such a fun journey.
When you do you solicit this? People come to you with these different ideas, or how have you been putting the books together?
You know, that's a great question. I kind of did the same thing I did with The Trap Door. I almost never solicit. And the problem with that is, what happens if you ask somebody for a contribution and they send you something that you don't like? Then you're stuck with a very awkward situation. So I figured that out very early on. So essentially, most people know what I do. They know how I do it. Mm-hmm. And the people who would create the kind of stuff that I like typically offer it to me. In fact, almost exclusively at this point. If I'm at a convention, I'll get to 4F, for example, and I'll have people meeting me in the lobby saying, I got something I got to show you. I think it'll work for your series. And then if it does, I film it and it ends up in the series. I have asked for a few items if I've seen somebody perform it or somebody comes. I have groups of people who are out there working on my behalf. Scott Robinson, Giancarlo Scalia, Lawrence Scheer, others who are looking for material for me, because I can't be everywhere at once. And if they, you know, find something that's really great, they tell me about it. And then they say, you know, if you want, I can talk to the guy. And if I'm not there with the guy, I don't mind having the conversation. But if I'm not there with the guy, they'll have the conversation for me. Mm-hmm. And they're very good at being selective.
And so when they're talking with them, do they write it up and give it to you, or do they film it and show it to you and then you write up the description?
I almost always do the write-up. There are a few people, very few. Marty Kane is one. Max Maven is another. And Lewis Jones is another. Those three people I edit very, very lightly, except when I'm adding my own thoughts about it. But typically, they all three are very good writers. And sure. So I put it sometimes in my voice, because it shouldn't sound like it's just a compost heap where you've thrown a bunch of different stuff in there and hope they'd all blend. I basically put it in my voice and then we're good to go. But those three people oftentimes write it up very well to begin with. Everybody else, I pretty much start from scratch. And I'm usually working from video.
And do you usually have a deadline or something in mind whenever that you're putting this together? Or is it kind of like, you know, okay, this is my last book. And then you start accumulating more stuff and say, well, I think I finally got enough for another book.
Great question. I always thought, or at least 9 out of the 12 times, I always thought I was working on the last volume. And so that's kind of, you know, for me, interesting, because when I complete the volume, I was never immediately looking for more stuff.
Sure.
Once I played around and, you know, with my own stuff for a while and started to accumulate enough for a book, at that point, I'd make a decision. Oftentimes the decision was to go forward. And at that point, I'd let some of my friends know. The word would get out. People would still send me stuff. I remember for volume 7, at the end of volume 7, if you look through volume 6 and 7, they came out at the same time. If you look through there, it very clearly says there are a lot of jokes about it being the last volume or the last pair of volumes. Mm-hmm. And that was my intent. And when I went to Spain the next year, Ramon Riobo, who always has a one-man chapter in there, he said, I've got some stuff for you. And I go, well, you know, I'm not writing anymore. And he goes, yeah, you'll write more. He said, just film it and then you'll use it. And sure enough, it wasn't until a year later that I decided, ooh, okay, well, I do have enough, you know, quality material for another book. So I'd start writing it. And that's when the gates kind of open and the contributions would come flowing in.
But you put those two together kind of like, I guess, Back to the Future 2 and 3 that were filmed at the same time. So this way that you kind of but saved one and put it out at a later time.
I was coming home. I was flying home, I think, from London, and I was on a plane. And I thought this would be a perfect, you know, 8 hours of dead time. So I thought this would be a perfect time to do the table of contents for the next volume of stuff I have in various stages of writing up.
Uh-huh.
So I started making the list and doing, you know, diagramming it. The problem is on the current list that I had, I was putting a chapter full of material down as one item. If I had a whole chapter on a particular topic, I had that listed as one item. So when I started exploding those
like
chapter
oil and water
titles.
Or something.
Yeah,
like
except that. I don't have any oil and water in the series, but that's the type of thing.
Okay.
It would be like having 10 oil and water items in a chapter and calling that one item. Mm-hmm. And so what happened is on the plane, I started splitting them apart because I never, you know, again, until I decide to do it, I don't do it.
Right.
Once I decide I'm going to do a book, then it's time to split it out and say, okay, let me get a map of where I'm going to go with this. And I started splitting it out. I go, oh my gosh, this is 2 volumes. And I debated on, do I do one volume now and maybe one volume later? I said, no, let me just go ahead and do both. They're already done. Let me go ahead and do both volumes at the same time. Swore I'd never do it again because of the volume of work that you have to deal with when it's more than twice the amount of work. Because, you know, it's one thing getting one cover perfected or one dust jacket perfected. It's a whole in writing one introduction. But if you have double that, mm-hmm. it just really sucks up the time. So I did it, but then I did it again for volumes 9 and 10. Not sure why, but I think I'd forgotten the pain.
Well, the fact that you had a full-time job and, in fact, owned your own company, and so you had employees and obligations and family and everything else, that you're putting this together in between your personal business. It's an amazing thing that you've done.
Very, very, very much so, the full-time job. I didn't actually own the business. I was the CEO of the business.
Oh.
It was a housing authority, a large urban housing authority, and I was the executive director. Which is abbreviated ED, something I wish they would have changed. But But anyway, basically, I was the CEO, and we had five companies under our umbrella, so I ran those. We had right at 170 employees at our highest point. I think it was 167 at our highest point. But, yeah, it was a full-time, and I was very engaged with that. Love what I did. Mm-hmm. But now I've been retired for 6 years, and I got to admit, I'm loving what I'm doing now, too.
And so what are you doing now? Is it mainly working with the books and putting together some different ideas and performing, or what?
Actually, I still get up same time every day and get dressed, and I go out on the front porch and I wave to all the other people who are working, you know, going to work. And I think that's kind of, you know, I think they count on that for their motivation.
Yeah, kind of like Clint Eastwood in Gran Torino, you know, just
yeah, exactly. Sitting, yeah,
get
exactly.
Those kids off my yard lawn.
No, knowing that I'm behind them all the way, you know, I think that's important to them. But yeah, now basically I'm catching up on some of my reading. I've developed an intense interest in magic history, something I always had, but something I didn't have the time to pursue. And then I've put out, I guess since I've been retired, I've put out one, two, three, I think four volumes, which is at a record pace. But I had 9 and 10 already ready to go out when I was going through the retirement process. Mm-hmm. So 9 and 10 were already done. They were immediately released. And then because I average about 2 years per book. So I'm working on the books. I'm working on magic history. I'm reading a lot of stuff that I didn't get to read when I was working on the books with a day job, because there was just not enough time to read all the books that I bought.
Sure.
So now I'm catching up on all of that.
As far as the books go, it's interesting. I want to kind of go back, I guess, to the beginning over there when you started writing that. Why was it necessarily the semi-automatic as opposed to automatic card tricks or self-working tricks? Was that kind of the basics of that? And then you thought, I don't want this to be self-working. How did that come about?
Well, I think for me, the idea of self-working, and don't get me wrong, I get it. Fulvis wrote an excellent series of books, and I would encourage everybody to read them. Read them, study them, and pull from them. My issue, and I don't like getting bogged down in semantics, but perhaps the one time I have was when I was selecting a title for this. I don't like the idea that the magician really isn't needed. Self-working implies that it all happens by itself. Anybody right. can become a magician and do it tonight. Semi-automatic, that's not the case. Semi-automatic means it's not physically difficult. Doesn't mean there are no moves, doesn't mean there are no sleights, but you're not going to find a pass in there. You're not going to find difficult moves. What you're going to find is a lot of tricks that anybody with an aptitude for and an inclination to do magic could do. And so it's not self-working because it is going to take practice. And the other thing I feel is, part of that is, when I branded that term, part of that was you need to put in entertainment value. And that's some of the hardest work that goes into that. And that's certainly not self-working. Ask somebody to develop a character and see how hard a problem that is. Mm-hmm. So that's why I was filling a gap in my mind. And it was a gap. I wanted to use the same. I'll elaborate just a little bit more. I was working a lot for magicians, and I was working a lot for laymen at the time. So I decided, rather than have two entirely separate repertoires, what I wanted to do is to have one repertoire that would work for both. So I thought, well, how do I do that? If I'm going to fool magicians, the way to fool magicians is with a principle, because it's very difficult to be fooled. If you do 10 passes yourself, and mm-hmm. I probably did about that many at the time, it was very difficult to be fooled by something using a pass. You would at least know that when the pass was done, because you do it yourself and you've been through it hundreds of times yourself. So by switching to a principle, if you're not familiar with the principle, you can very easily be fooled. And so what I did is I combined a lot of principles and came up with a few of my own, put them to work, and as a result had something that would fool magicians. And then I put the presentation to it to entertain laymen. And kind of the light going off moment for me was when I realized that, if you can make a down under deal entertaining, mm-hmm. And I never would have thought 20 years ago I would ever do a down under deal.
Right.
But then when I figured out a way to make it entertaining, I thought, well, if you can make this entertaining, you can make pretty much anything entertaining. So mm-hmm. then I was able to consolidate my repertoires and basically use the same for both magicians and laymen, with the goal of fooling the magicians, entertaining the laymen, and hopefully entertaining both.
When you were performing then for magicians and for laymen, I don't remember seeing you attend really a lot of conventions. I mean that you're not one who goes out and lectures a lot at conventions, still don't necessarily, even though you're retired right now. Is that something you've consciously thought of, that you just kind of like staying and working and writing, or are you thinking about going out and doing some conventions?
That's probably a matter of our different geography. I mean, I've been through Texas, I think, twice on a lecture tour. I did go about 15 to 20 years where the only lecture tours I did were in Europe. And that was, you know, that was partly the fact that I like to eat strange foods. Mm-hmm. I like to visit and learn about different cultures, and I like to do magic, and that kind of combined everything. I actually, at my high spot, have probably attended as many as 10 to 11 conventions a year. Probably on average, it was 6. I always do the Winter Carnival in Pigeon Forge. Mm-hmm. It used to be in Gatlinburg. I always do 4F. Mm-hmm. When 31 Faces was up in Toronto, I always did that. Then I typically have a break and only do the conventions where I'm booked. And then I would do in October, I do Trix. In November, well, now it's in November. And in October, I do Escorial in Spain. And I just finished doing the Carl Lafon gathering in Scotland. That was just a few months ago. Mm-hmm. So, I think that was October, November. So I've been very fortunate to have the opportunity to do that. I enjoy doing it. I think last year I did Abbott's close-up convention. So I think it's just more that we perhaps haven't been to the same ones. We always see each other, you know, when we're working together, like at 4F, or I think a couple times I've been to TAOM, and that's about when we see each other.
Right. When you said you came through Texas, that must have been back when, a long time ago, when Bob Carlback was still booking.
Exactly. Exactly. Bob Carlback.
So, because I started booking lectures in 2002, and he was doing that, I think he passed sometime around 99 or 2000 or something like that.
Right.
So it's been a while since you've last toured out here.
It has. Hint, hint. Yeah.
Well, you know, one of the best conventions where we were attending, speaking of the Pigeon Forge, was when we got stuck together in Gatlinburg at the Winter Carnival due to a blizzard. And yes, that was just one of the most amazing conventions. First of all, I just think that it was, hate to use the word magic, but it was something that will never happen again. I couldn't imagine that all of us being in the same place and then getting into a tight place that we couldn't get out of. People couldn't get in. I remember that the CNN helicopter was taking photos and video from above and showing the city, and whoever was running the convention said, hey, we got enough magicians here, let's just go for another 24 hours and extend the convention. And you picked up and responded beautifully to one of the things that was one of the highlights, I thought, of the convention, of something you did with snowballs.
Well, the funny thing about that convention, first of all, for people to get perspective, it was 30 inches of snow. That was the
in 24
official
hours.
Count. Yeah, it was the 1993 Winter Carnival of Magic held in Gatlinburg, Tennessee. And a lot of the town ran out of power. But in addition to that, the restaurants, you couldn't get in or out of town because there were trees over the roads. And there are only two ways in and out at the time. It's one main road. It goes in and goes through the town and goes out.
Right.
And so with trees over the road, you couldn't get out. We couldn't get out till Monday. So, this was before cash machines were a thing. They had them, but they were not, you know, commonplace. I didn't have a
cell phones either. I don't particularly remember.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No cell phones. And so,
email or any of that.
I went to Jerry Mincer and said, Jerry, I need some money. And I wrote him a check and he gave me $200, and that's what paid for the rest of the weekend for me. But in addition to that, I was asked at about 4 o'clock if I would be, I was told they were going to put on a show at 8 p.m. and ask if I would do the stage show. And I said, well, all I've got are my street clothes. I said, if you're okay with that, I'm okay with that. They said, yeah, that's fine. And I said, okay, I got to go figure out an act. So I went and bought a couple of coolers, and put together an act out of snow, mostly making, I won't say making fun of, but having fun with some of the acts they had seen during the convention. And the funny thing about that to me was, on Sunday, when we were getting ready to go out, Diane Maney in the parking lot, who booked the Atlanta Harvest of Magic, said she wanted to book me doing that act that November for the Atlanta Harvest. And I said, Diane, unless you're going to have 30 inches of snow, I got points for being topical.
Yes.
So it's probably not going to happen. So, I didn't tell you the rest of that story, too, by the way. We did get out on the interstate, and it took us several hours to get out on the interstate. Literally, though, by 9 o'clock, we left at 10 in the morning. By 9 p.m. on Monday, we came to a, we had only come less than 60 miles, and we were sitting on the interstate, and we were came to a complete halt, as did everybody. And we spent the night literally on the interstate because you couldn't move to get to an exit. There were these big drifts of snow that were, you know, 8 and 10 feet high on either side of us. And it turned out that in Asheville, which was a good hour plus in front of us, two 18-wheelers had jackknifed. I think one had gone off a bridge, and I-40 was blocked as a result. So we spent the night. There were three of us, Mike Beam, Don Morris, and me. We spent the night in my van with precious little gas, turning it on and off periodically to turn the, you know, to get heat.
Right.
So at 5 a.m. the next morning, the police came through, woke everybody up. Everybody started moving. And I think I got home about, what was it, 5, 6 o'clock that afternoon. So it took a day and a half to get home.
Well, my story was, in returning home, that I had, you remember Gary Ward? Course.
Oh, yeah.
Because Gary is one of the people who is backstage at the 4F. Sure. Kind of helps put everything all together and mics everybody and everything. And Gary and I have been friends for a long time. Well, he had a job in which that he traveled so much that he had free airline tickets. So when we went to begin with, he said, I can cover you. You know, so the two of us, you know, I got a companion flies free ticket. I said, great. So I don't remember if he and I roomed together or not. But anyhow, I remember hanging out a lot with Giovanni. Remember that was the year when Gio was there. That was, he did some really great stuff too. And I'd forgotten who all else was there, but it was a good group of people. But on the return home, when they finally did clear the roads, I was driving the rental car, and I was trying to get around some of the cars that were driving slower, and I felt like I could pass them, but apparently he had car sickness, and so he kept saying, you need to slow down, Scott, Scott, and every time he would, you know, just kind of make that noise, I'd say, okay, and then I would, when he wasn't watching, I'd try to pass, and then he would start that again. Well, we finally got, as I recall, we weren't flying out of Knoxville, I think we were flying out of Birmingham, and after about 4 hours of driving, which should have taken about 45 minutes, that finally got there, and it was late in the evening, missed the last flight to Houston, and as a result, I was sleeping on the floor of the airport. So at least, you know, it was warm. I didn't have what you had, you know, in the car, turning it on and off. But we had to sleep on the floor. And then the next day, I got into work, and my boss said, "Well, I'm gonna have to dock you a day, or charge you as a vacation day." And I was the vice president of the company. It was the president that told me. I said, "Hey, look." I'm sorry. I said it was a force majeure situation. And he said, well, you should have planned on that. I said, you can't plan on that. I couldn't come back on my original days. I was planning on being back before Monday. But nevertheless, so that was kind of my story. But that was really a great convention, which goes back to what I think your forte is. And that is of being, as you mentioned, topical, certainly like you do at the 4F convention as the MC, as you kind of take a look at what it is that the other acts have done. I always like it when you're going to be the MC for the third or fourth day, because you've already had enough people who have performed, and then you make a comment about somebody that, again, is quite topical and funny. That's why we really haven't had a chance to talk together, because that you're always kind of in your room working on some fresh material.
I'm everywhere. I'm usually at a restaurant working on fresh material, but I think that's what's made 4F kind of exciting for me. I always try and add topical material, no matter what convention I'm at. That's why I don't like to be early at a convention. I'd prefer to be later on, you know, on the program later in the convention, because I can take advantage of something that happens. But 4F has been, you know, that's basically all of us getting in touch with our inner grade schooler, I think. And so we show up, everybody's prepped to have a good time. And as things occur during the course of the week, I try and make, you know, look at it and see how can that be funny. And I also have a group of people who are usually hanging with me, or I'm hanging with them. They include, Gary Morton, Tim Williams, Tom Craven, and Bob Macy, and others. And the other thing about 4F is that's, I think, maybe a little different than most, is really those of us who do similar types of things are always trying to help each other. It's not unusual for somebody to come up right in the middle of my show while the performer's on, and I'm backstage thinking about the lines that I wrote this morning and wondering how many of those I'm going to remember when I get out there. Mm-hmm. And somebody will come and say, hey, have you thought about this? And literally the show's going on, and I either go, that won't work for me, or I can't deliver that in a funny way, or I'll go, man, that's gold. Okay, perfect. And then I try and add on to that. And then, 6 minutes later, I'm out in front of an audience trying it out for the first time. First, probably, and last time.
And last time, too, right.
Yeah. I remember one time there was a performer on who had some music going on. This was I was actually closing the Saturday night show, something I used to do before I asked off. And I didn't do any magic. I just did 20 to 25 minutes talking about the convention in retrospect. And I went out there, and there was a guy who had some music playing. And Jamie Swiss was standing at the sidelines right before right where you go on. Mm-hmm. And as I was walking toward being introduced, actually, they were doing my introduction. Jamie said, why don't you take that music and just spin it up and use the same music for your act? And I just that was literally I'm walking by him at a slow pace. Then they give me my name. And I got out there. And just because we know each other so well, all of us there. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I just said, spin that music up again and let's use it for my act. And that got a great laugh. It was a great opening. And it literally, it couldn't have been 10 seconds from the time it left his lips till the time it came out of my mouth. Yeah. But it went over well because they know what to expect.
Well, that's the neat thing about that convention. Number one, a lot of people will do their pet effects or something that they're well known for or they've been working on for a long time. Or it might be something that is experimental that they want to try before the group of us that may or may not work. I remember Dan Harlan doing something one year.
The cheese act,
the ham and cheese thing.
Right.
It was a good thought, but it didn't work, but
right.
Kind of, I'm sure, led to other ideas. But at least people aren't afraid when you're among friends like this who are creative themselves and can come up with some good ideas, give you a lot of good input for everything if you are trying something new.
And I've been going there now 30, I think 30 years. I think mm-hmm. that's right. I think maybe next year is my 30th year. But, and I think in all the time I've been doing that, because people ask who get, are people offended by what you say? And because
do
you
they?
Are making, oh, often.
Huh. And, like, what do you think you've ever said that may have offended somebody? Why would they even think that?
I'm aware of three specific occasions, which I won't go into, but three specific occasions where the person actually got offended by what I said.
Wow.
Interestingly, one of them misunderstood. Actually, I did four jokes about one person and one person's act, and they misunderstood each one of the jokes, which was to me really interesting. And that's actually when I asked off. I said, I told Obie, I said, it's getting to a point where this is many years ago. This was, 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. I said, I enjoyed doing the thing, but if people are starting to get offended, why don't you go ahead and take me off the thing. And, because I do a certain style, and if that style is going to offend people, that's not my goal. These are friends of mine.
Sure.
I just assume not go on.
Right.
So he said, that's up to you. In fact, that's when Steve Bargatze and Rick Merrill started closing the show. Mm-hmm. I think they've done an excellent job, but they do a similar type of humor, too.
Right.
So and I know they've offended people as well.
A lot of theirs is slapstick, which is different from yours as being, well, wouldn't say caustic, but it is something that is hard-hitting satire, I guess. In some way.
Yeah, it's just subtle, I think. It's typically subtle, but mm-hmm. And sometimes it's so subtle it's not understood. So
can you give
one
the listeners
whether it's actually humor?
Can you give the listeners like an example?
Oh goodness. My opening is typically, hi, my name's Steve Beam. For those of you who don't know me, I'm a graduate of the Darwin Ortiz School for Humorous Patter, and I teach at the David Blaine School for Video Editing. Okay, well, that's not, and then I typically will alter that. There was one year at 4F, somebody had, a well-known magician, I won't use his name, but a well-known magician to everybody, tried to do humor, and he crashed and burned. So mm-hmm. I think I tweaked the line to, I'm a graduate of the blankety-blank school of humorous magic or something to that effect. I forget exactly what it was, but I tweaked them based on what's going on at the convention.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I've had three people get upset that I know about, and that was prior to me coming. Actually, two of them were prior to me coming off the Saturday night show. That was about 15 years ago. And then one since then, not all that long ago. And then I have had a few years ago, great example, I think. I had a joke about that involved Ed Eckel. Ed Eckel, Ron Zolwig, and Bill Meisel, and the Precursor Suite. And I made a joke about the new people who were running the Precursor Suite, because, you know, that's the, for those of you who aren't familiar, that's the suite that Ed Eckel, Bill Meisel, Ron Zolwig used to run before they died.
Because they had the magazine Precursor, and they were looking, right. Hopefully people would come there, and they would be doing tricks that they could put into their publication.
Exactly. So, but my point was, I delivered that line, and I said, you know, that's the suite that they ran before they died. Well, at that point, everybody thought I'd made a mistake, because Ed Eckel was still alive. And so I hear all these, you know, big gasp and oohs and everything. And I said, oh, well, yeah, I know. But you mean Ed? Yeah, I get it. But technically, you know, come on. And I looked at my watch as if I were clocking it.
Yeah.
Well, I had a friend sitting out in the audience, and he said the person on either side of him was offended by that joke. Well, the funny thing was, Ed was in on it. Ed came up to me, actually, while I'm doing it, Ed's in the audience. I will always use it when they're in the audience.
Sure.
And I started doing updates. Every time I'd come out for the next MC bit, I'd go, have we got an update on Ed Eckel? You know, and and so I would do that, and I'd check my watch and say, any minute now, you know. And then they were apparently getting more and more upset every time I would do this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then I had Ed Eckel come out for the last Ed Eckel update, no, the second to the last one, and give a thumbs up. And he just came out, smiled, gave a thumbs up, and then walked off. And they were still offended.
Really?
When Ed was in on his own joke, which made no sense. And then, of course, I finished it by the last time I came out. I said, we got an Ed Eckel update. And I paused, and I go, oh, sorry. Okay, well, let's keep moving, as if he had passed
yeah,
during the
right.
show. But Ed came up to me. And I think I've got the letter he wrote afterwards that thanked me for making him relevant. You know, he said, because Ed had, if you knew Ed at all, you knew he had a terrific sense of humor. And
yes.
He was known for that more than he was his magic, even.
Right, right.
And he did, you know, he did good magic, but his sense of humor was terrific. And he was delighted to be part of that.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, anytime I can help you out, let me know. But there are at least two people in the audience who are offended at him making fun of his own, you know, ultimate death, something we all go through.
Yeah. Didn't he invent the elephant zipper?
Yes, the Moby Zip.
Yeah.
Which was put out by Excelsior Productions, which was a partnership between Rick Johnson and Phil Wilmarth back long, long ago.
I want to get to that in just a second then also,
sure.
too. You know, I was just thinking when you were saying, looking at your watch, that he's got 10 left. And then someone, you know, should have said, you mean 10 years or 10 months? And you're saying
nine, eight,
yeah.
Seven. Yeah, exactly the kind of joke. Well, another example, not to get too far off on this, but another example was, I think you were there just a few years ago, when a foreigner, and I get it, different, you know, different
cultures.
Mores for different societies, but
sure.
a foreigner came in and did a routine where he got a female up from the audience, and he did a routine using a condom.
I remember that.
Yeah. And it was, it didn't go over. It was offensive to many. I wasn't offended. I was very uncomfortable just for what was happening. This was prior to the whole Me Too and everything else stuff. But I wasn't offended. I just felt it was uncomfortable. It was a poor choice of material. And it did put the person who was up there, the female up there, in a really awkward position because, you know, she didn't think it was funny either, and she was trying not to ruin his act by demonstrating it right there. So I thought about that, and I thought, well, that's just too good for me not to use. But I
there's
thought
some
about
gold
how do
in
I,
there.
Yeah, there's gold in there, but how do I use it without, you know, having the same result he did,
exactly.
which was basically a whole convention upset with him.
Mm-hmm.
So what I did is I came out the next day I was introduced that afternoon. I came out to start the show, and I did it in pantomime, and I reached in my pocket and I pulled out what looked like a condom wrapper.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, looked at it, and you know, you could just already hear everybody writing the jokes themselves, thinking, "Oh my God, he's gonna crash and burn here too." I opened it with my teeth, you know, in kind of a Latin lover kind of, I'm passionate and ready for the moment. Then I slowly went through the whole process of undressing what, you know, the package, and reached in and pulled out Yeah, and there was also the shape of the package was rectangular, which made for other visual jokes with it, mostly self-deprecating jokes. And then, but when I ripped it open, pulled it out, it turned out to be a lens wipe, and I wiped my glasses. And basically, I think the opening line was, get your mind out of the gutters. Yeah. And that was, you know, and because of what had happened and where it was, it's not a line that would ever work ever again. I burned off more material than I'll ever, you know, get to use. It was all one-time material, because unless I follow that same guy again and he hadn't learned his lesson, and surely he has, then it's one-time material. But it went over and was a great opener.
Well, that's great, because that's something that has already been said and everything's going on in people's minds. That is beautiful comedy, which that it's all visual and you haven't done a thing except created something again in their minds. I think that's great. That's something that a lot of the late night talk show hosts and topical comedians do, in which they rip comedy from today's headlines. They just take a look at that. And so it sounds like that you've kind of surrounded yourself with some excellent writers, some other comedy thinkers and people who can kind of throw in their 2 cents worth. And then you put it in some good lines, throw out some other ones that are not going to work and fine tune and everything. But you have to take a look at what is it that we can laugh at today. Every day and every age, it doesn't matter whether you're in 2020 or 2030 or 2010, there's going to be something happening daily that is serious, but, you know, can have a joke about it. And it's just, I think that you look on the bright side of things, and I like the way that you think.
I think it's all about having fun. I mean, I do this. The only reason I do magic is I find it enjoyable. And and to me, I was also the class clown. And so this is really my ways of combining the things, whatever my strengths are, combine them and to make it more fun for me. And if I can make it more fun for everybody who happens to be in the audience, that's a terrific thing. If I don't make it fun, then I won't be up there in front of the audience, and that's fine. But I love the fact that I show up with a ton of material. I used to not. I used to show up with nothing other than I was going to do a trick. You know, everybody gets up and does their 7 minutes. I was going to do a trick. Then when it became, you know, when I got a regular gig, you know, working as I was hosting a show as an MC, first of all, I was closing the Saturday night show. And I wasn't doing magic. I was just doing comedy stand-up. And mostly based on stuff that happened the weekend. So I would show up and wait for stuff to happen. And then I'd make fun of it and usually get 3 or 4 lines out of each. And then move to the next topic and 3 or 4 lines. Next topic, 3 or 4 lines. Well, that worked fine. But then I thought I had an epiphany one day going home. So, well, you know, this was all great. But what would have happened if nothing funny or not, you know, it had happened during the week? Then I'd be sitting there with a slot to fill and, you know, a lot of silence. And I thought I should start bringing material. So now I bring enough to introduce. You know, I usually get the list of people who I'm introducing. So I try and get some humor out of that. And then I bring that and I bring about 80% of my material. Then when I get there, that group I mentioned earlier, usually we're going to dinner and they're seeing different things that I'm seeing. And we just think about different things to make fun of. And it can be anything from they're putting down new carpet at the hotel or the fact that, you know, they use garbage bags to cover the ceilings because they have sky roof. Right. Yeah. And, you know, the sunroof. So to cover them up so that you don't end up with, you know, sun shining directly down on a performer.
Yeah, well, that reminds me. I remember Al the Only one time doing a card on ceiling kind of a thing, and he hurt his back, which I think is still injured to this day, because as he was throwing a card up into the ceiling there, that as he looked up and he was letting it go, he kind of hitched his back because he knew he had to give it a little bit of an extra oomph because he saw it was going up into the skylight instead of just the ceiling. He had to go a little bit further than he thought he did. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And so that would have been great if that would have only happened right before I went on. See, I would have gotten probably 2 minutes out of that. I would have gotten more time out of it than he got out of it, just because it was fresh in everybody's mind, and you know it would have been funny. And he's a great performer, but he's focused on an act. I'm focused on the screw up. Or the funny thing that occurred. That wasn't actually a screw-up, but on the funny thing that occurred.
No, exactly right. Now, whenever that you're performing, though, and doing some funny shtick there for the 4F, we all know each other, that's one thing. But when you go to a convention, or perhaps even that you're doing a corporate thing, I would assume that you may not necessarily know the room, or you don't have the feel. I mean, when you go to Fectors, you have a feel from the room because you've been there before. But when you're going to someplace new, do you still write some material, or are there some things out of bounds there that you would consider in bounds within the context of friends at the Fectors?
There are definitely some things that are out of bounds, things I would do at 4F that I wouldn't do elsewhere. And it's not the kind of thing, I mean, it's not misogynistic, it's not racist, it's not, you know, nowadays they've used those terms to the point where they have no meaning. So If people are going to get offended, even when you're doing non-offensive stuff, then you can pretty much just forget about offending them and go right on out and do the stuff, because people are going to be offended regardless. So when you take that, put that aside. But an example of the trouble I go to, Magic. I worked Magic Live last summer. Stan puts on a great convention. I'd never been to it. He called. He said, "How about let's do this?" I did. Went out there, and I wrote some lines about the hotel. And I wrote some lines about Stan, and I sent him an email. I got to thinking about it, and I thought, you know, I don't know. Stan's not seen me work. Right. Surely he's heard about it, but he's not seen me work. So I emailed him, and I said, literally, the convention's going on, and it's the day before I'm doing my thing, which was, I don't remember what day, but anyway. So I emailed him, and I said, "Stan, I've got 3 jokes about the hotel, and I've got 3 jokes about you." I said, "You know, some might consider them offensive, but I'm just, you know, picking on the quality of the hotel and, you know, different the restaurants and the service and that type of thing. The stuff I do at 4F.
Right.
And I've got a couple of jokes about the way you run the convention." I said, "If you would like to know the jokes, I'll be glad to email them to you. You tell me thumbs up, thumbs down on them, and you can either do it with or without seeing them." And he sent back what I thought was one of the greatest notes ever. He said, he says, "I'm good. And I think the hotel has been here long enough that they can withstand a joke or two or three about their service." And I thought, you know, that's the kind of guy you like to work for. And it made my presentation far better. Did I get some, you know,
because you felt comfortable about giving the joke, knowing that it was okay.
I felt comfortable that the guy who booked me and who was not the butt of the joke, there was no butt to the joke.
Yeah,
they were just humorous things I had observed and I didn't have them before I went to the convention because, you know, I just hadn't thought of them until I was there and saw what the convention was like. And I thought, well, if the guy who booked me is comfortable with it and he is the subject of the joke or the hotel that he's responsible for choosing, then I'm good to go. Now, so I used lines in that, you know, I made fun of a lot of things and a lot of people, but you know, I said, well, let's use Jamie Swiss. Jamie is I think he's a dear friend. He's a great magician. I saw him work the castle last year or the year before, and he was to me the highlight of my visit. I didn't expect that. I had not seen him work layman before ever. Mm-hmm. And I've known him for 20, 30 years, but he killed.
Yeah.
But I'm always making fun of the fact that he uses the pass so many times. And, you know, the fact that it sounds like a loose fan belt on a 57 Chevy, you know, when he does it. But see, he's got one of my favorite lines. I tell him when I see him, I got a new Jamie Swiss line, and I tell it to him because if he's not there, I love for him to be there for these one. And he's been there for many, but like at 31 Faces in Toronto. But one of my lines in Toronto was he wasn't there that year. And I said, I understand Jamie couldn't be here this year. Let's see if I can remember it. I said, I understand Jamie couldn't be here this year because, he's got a, and I put it in air quotes, a gig. Yeah, and I said, I got a Commodore 64 at the house that's got more gigs than Jamie's seen in a decade. And, you know, it just, none of it's true, but it's hopefully funny.
Yeah,
and
people know the difference.
He's great.
Sure.
Yeah, of course. And Jamie is man enough to not only take it, but dish it right back out. And he's funny. So that's the kind of person I like to work with. So in answer to your question, I think 31 faces, you could do anything up in Toronto. David Benn, Alan Slate, you know, Julie Ng, put on that conference. And we had a small group, 35 people, terrific right. convention, one of the best I've ever been to, 4F, and then select conventions during the year. And you can get away with more stuff. But certainly the two best are, I think, 31 Faces and 4F for that kind of material. For me.
So as you're putting together comedy, you know, I was thinking also about something that Jerry Seinfeld had famously said, that he really can't work any longer for colleges because on that circuit that everyone is so politically correct that and his humor is not. He's trying to be topical and trying to be edgy as well, and there are a lot of comedians like that who can't work in some certain areas. Do you kind of self-censor yourself, think, oh, that's really funny, but I really can't say that?
I do that all the time, and I even do that at 4F. You should hear the ones that don't actually make it on. And actually, one of the jobs of the people who are with me who are, I would say, adding seasoning to what I do, is they try and come up with lines that I won't use, you know, and they said, but I bet you won't use this one. Yeah. And there have been times when I say, yeah, well, you're right. Usually, though, because it's not funny. Okay. Mm-hmm. But other times I don't use it because it's offensive. And sometimes, you know, I have some really great lines that even I won't use. I don't do drug humor much. Mm-hmm. I don't find drugs that funny, just for me personally. I'm not offended by it. I just don't find it funny, so I don't use it. And I'll be honest, I don't know enough about it to do it.
Yeah.
But I did when Canada put in the recreational marijuana thing. Mm-hmm. Joan Caesar sent me a note telling me about that because I hadn't heard about it. They voted it in nationally. And that got me 5 minutes on that. Seriously, 5 minutes because they brought me back on the Saturday evening show to do some humor there on it. So I got a grand total of probably 5 minutes on drugs, on marijuana, and mm-hmm. on something else they had done that year. So, I mean, I'm always looking for things in the real world that I can apply to that type of thing. But, yeah, I censor a lot. But I will say this, like I said earlier in the discussion, I'm no longer, you know, I ask off the Saturday night show at 4F because I offended one guy. Now, don't get me wrong. I did it, I think, in two non-consecutive years, a different guy. Mm-hmm. And I just decided, you know, if I'm going to offend people, I'm not going to do it. But now that everybody's using being offended to get power, you know, because if you're the offended person, all of a sudden everybody there is bending over backwards to placate you. I no longer care.
Right.
You know, don't get me wrong. If I find something offensive, I won't do it. But if I find something funny and it's really funny, then I'm probably going to use it. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to worry about who I offend. Well, I'm not going to take side. Almost everybody who I've offended, who I deliver lines about, almost every one of them is a good friend of mine. Almost.
Yeah.
You know, including one of the people I offended. Go figure.
Well, yeah, and because over the years that you've met so many different people and you have such good and high respect within the community that I'm sure that you have just a wide variety of friends, so I can understand that then, too. Now, as for the comedy that you're writing then as well, which you are saying like is a one-off kind of a thing and something that's used then for conventions or as an MC or whatever, are there things also that you write for yourself as far as scripting for tricks that you're doing that when you're performing? And I'm assuming you do you work like cocktail parties or restaurants or what kind of a venue or
I no longer perform for the regular public. And the reason why is when I became the CEO, we had our corporation. It's a quasi governmental corporation. One of the five that I was responsible for was a quasi governmental corporation. So I had a board appointed by the mayor. And it just was because there were government funds involved. Mm-hmm. If I went out to if somebody came to me and said, well, we want to book you for a show and I go do that show. Then 2 weeks later, the guy who booked me calls me and turns out he runs a construction firm and he wants to do some work. Then I've got the conflict of interest. I've got a conflict of interest if he actually gets the job, even if he's the low bidder. So
the perception, at least, of the conflict of interest.
Absolutely. Right. And I was a public figure, so it wasn't worth the risk to me. So I just decided back when I took over that no more public shows. I did keep a couple of them down in South Carolina. I used to do the South Carolina Merchants Association, several other groups that I would do on a fairly regular basis. And I kept some of those because they weren't, you know, none of them were competing for business up here. But I just decided, you know, it really isn't worth the risk. And for me, it's always been the job first.
Right.
Take care of business there, because that's what puts food on the table. The rest of the money is fun money. As Trevor Lewis says, magic is good cake, bad bread. So you take care of the bread, the bread part, and then the cake is there if you want to take advantage of that as well.
Lagniappe, as they'd say in Louisiana.
Yeah, absolutely. Lagniappe.
Yeah.
Give all you can of that which costs you nothing. And that's that little extra you toss in there for free.
So whenever that you're performing then for the public or for magicians, again, do you script your material then and then keep that, or do you keep refining that all the time?
I'm always refining it, although there are a few routines that I've been doing since the 70s that are, I mean, I only do my own material. I do maybe half a dozen tricks that aren't mine. But for those that are mine, there are some that I've been doing since the 70s that were fully, I liked the presentation when I got them then, and when I developed them and wrote the presentation evolved over the years, and now it's so in with the trick that I don't really vary the presentation, unless, you know, but I'm not on autopilot, so if something goes on in the room, I can still stop, take advantage, and go right back to the trick. I like that. But yeah, I spend a lot of time scripting, and I typically put the scripts in the books. If I've got a full on script with the material, it goes in the books because it's different than DVDs. I think DVDs oftentimes have the potential to create clones.
Good point.
Whereas, I mean, if you see me do something on a video and it's funny, you go, "Oh, that would work. I'll use that,"
right.
And then that you incorporate that into your work. But if you're reading it, you are not hearing me deliver the lines. You are putting my words into your mouth. So you're delivering my words, but with your mouth. And so you hear what it sounds like when you say them as you're reading the book.
It has to do with timing.
And if you find that funny when you're reading it, then there's a better chance, I think, that when you put it in front of an audience, that they're going to find it funny and it's going to sound more natural because you're reading it in your voice. You're not delivering a carbon copy of what you saw me do. I know this because when I had a shop when I was in college, I owned a magic shop in Columbia, South Carolina. And I would, you know, go to class in the morning and then go to the shop in the afternoon and evening. And I had a lot of little Steve Beam clones running around doing, you know, basically my act verbatim. That's not an insult. That's how they learned, and that was fine. But I thought, I don't really want that eliminates, if you do that nationally, that eliminates your ability to go to a convention and work for magicians, because they've already seen the trick and they assume you're doing somebody else's trick when in fact it was mine.
Right. Well, listen, before we start to wrap up, I do want to get back to something that's going to take a little bit of time to talk about, and that is the Excelsior Productions, because I remember Rick Johnson having a column in the Linking Ring magazine so many years ago, and he had such creative ideas. And I thought what was interesting about that is that he created things because he felt like he lived in the middle of the wastelands of magic. There were no other magic clubs or anybody around that he can kind of consult with. And you know, back in the old days when you had to write letters and put stamps on it and wait for a reply or make a phone call to somebody and it cost for your long distance phone call or whatever. So he had a lot of really cool ideas and in the magazine, in the Linking Ring Journal, that he used to explain how that you could make these things. And I made a lot of those things way back when then as well. And then he became partners with the later, who was the editor of Phil Wilmarth, with the Excelsior Productions. And so you were saying, taken over or acquired the Excelsior production rights?
No. What I did actually, those still rest with Robbie, Phil's wife, because when Rick died, they went to Phil, and then when Phil died, you know, obviously Robbie has the rights. But no, I ended up with Phil's library, and I ended up with his correspondence, and I was this was prior to the tape starting today. I just mentioned that I had spent the weekend going through the Rick Johnson correspondence and separating it out from the Phil Wilmarth correspondence, because it's all very interesting. It's all magic related. And it's just a ton of history there. They acquired the lines of Hen Fetch, for example, Gene Gordon. Who's the guy who wrote 40 Years at the Forks?
Wasn't Jerry Mentzer.
He was a regular at... I shouldn't have brought it up because I will, it'll pop in my head probably in a minute. But anyway, they acquired his line, you know, Pete Tappan's book rights to The Imposter's Princess. All this stuff they acquired, and it ultimately, you know, Phil even acquired Irv Weiner's material, paid Irv for that. So Phil was big on acquiring the material of others, and Rick and he were going to do a lot of production. But, you know, I didn't realize this. In fact, I didn't realize it till over the weekend, but Rick died when he was 52 years old.
Oh, I didn't realize he was that young either. Wow.
Neither did I. And so they had big plans. And of course, when he died, then Phil became international president.
Wasn't it a
stroke?
He
was already the
editor. I thought he had like a heart attack or something. Is that, you recall?
It was something sudden. It was something sudden.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't remember what it was, but I looked at, I was looking at the information and kind of, because I've got reams of it. I mean, I've got his handwritten Practical Impossibilities, which was the book he wrote, the big book he wrote. I've got the handwritten. He wrote it out longhand before giving it to somebody to type.
Wow.
So I ended up with that and a lot of his stuff. And Phil's stuff, of course. And so I was going through and dealing with that. It's kind of like getting to spend more time with them, old friends, which was good. But I didn't realize that he was only 52 when he died. I mean, that's amazing to me.
Yeah, and Phil lived many more years. Phil was late 70s, early 80s, late 70s, I think.
He actually was mid-80s.
Mid-80s, okay.
Yeah, he was right at, I want to say, 85. He might have been 84. He died in 2014 in September. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was a dear friend. He'd moved here from Chicago. We would go out and have lunch at least twice a month. We'd go out and have dinner together at least once a month. Mm-hmm. And terrific guy. Knew everybody. And fascinating guy. And I didn't realize, I would be talking about a particular thing I was researching, and I couldn't find a book. And then 2 weeks later, we're having lunch, and he'd have this folder with him that he'd wait until the middle of the meal. Mm-hmm. And then he'd slide it toward me. And I would say, what's this? And he wouldn't say anything. He'd just smile. And I would open it up, and it's this book that I've been looking all over for. And I'm going, Phil, why do you have this book? And he would just smile. He wouldn't tell me. I'd just say, why do you have this? This has nothing to do with what you do. You know, it's a heavy card book or something. Mm-hmm. And so it had nothing to do with what he did. But it turns out that he had also, over time, when friends had passed, they had given their collections, willed their collection to go to him. And so, he had Pete Tappan's, he had Rick Johnson's, and he had a lot of friends in Chicago who had passed, a lot of friends he'd made at 4F who had passed, and they all went to him. And so he had books. I'm sure he had no interest in reading them, but certainly I did. And I didn't know why he would even have them in his collection, but he did. And so it turned out great for me. Then ultimately, when he passed, I was helping Robbie get everything. Several of us were helping Robbie get everything ready to auction. And she just came in one night and she said, well, what if I wanted to just sell it to one person rather than an auction and keep it together? And I said, come up with a price that you'll forevermore be happy with. I'll give you some names of collectors. You know some names of collectors. Call them, ask them for the price. I mean, ask them for what they'd pay. And if they give you a figure that works, that's, higher than that figure that you'll forevermore be happy with, then take it. And then it's done. And we can take care of the shipping. And she said, okay, fine. She left the room. She came back a few minutes later and she said, well, what if I wanted to sell it to you? And I really hadn't planned. I had a large, in fact, mine was larger than his, but his was about 5,000 volumes.
Wow.
And he said, she said, what if I wanted to sell it to you? And I said, and I thought about it because I hadn't planned on doing it. I'd been working with her for 5 months to get it to someone else. And I said, same thing. You come up with a figure that you'll forevermore be happy with. And then if you name that figure and it works for me, I'll write you a check. And if it doesn't, I will, help you find somebody else who will, give you that figure for it. And she said, and if my figure's too high, then we'll negotiate. And I said, no, I said, because I asked you to take the figure that you'll forevermore be happy with.
Right.
I'm not going to have you regretting the sale to me because I'm a friend of yours. So anyway, she said, what if I said this number? I said, well, if that's the number, I'll go out to my car and get a checkbook. She said, well, that's the number. So I did, and I ended up with a collection. And I'm in the process of selling off the duplicates. But fortunately, there was a lot less overlap than I thought there would be.
So the correspondence you have with Rick Johnson right now, the reason you're splitting this out, are you thinking about putting that into a book or something?
No, I think I'm preparing for if anybody does. I think over time there were three different people who had expressed an interest, and then they started determining that they weren't sure there would be enough interest if they did the book. You know, collectors, as I found a lot about Magic History as I've gotten into it, they aren't doing large runs like you might do with a card book.
True.
They're doing much, much smaller runs and more limited editions, and of course they're higher priced. But there have been at least three people who have toyed with the idea of doing a book on Rick. And if that were ever to come to pass, then I have a fair amount of his material, correspondence, and he was going to do a shtick book. He's got his Linking Ring articles. I've got the letter from Howard Bamman, who preceded Phil as the editor, who gave him permission to, you know, put it all in print, including the illustrations. And then he's got all the stuff that were on all his lecture notes. And I think I've got all his lecture notes. And as I said, a fair amount of his correspondence. So there's a ton of material there if there's somebody there who wants to do that work. It's not what I do. I'm more of a beginner history guy. You know, I hang on every word that John Gaughan, Jim Steinmeier, Mike Caveney, and others say.
Right.
Because I'm really enjoying taking advantage of their knowledge now.
Yes. Well, as we close, then also as far as your future, that you have any plans necessarily again for another book, number 13? Seems like a nice ring to it as far as the number.
I actually put a period on the 12 will be the last of the semi-automatic cartridge series. The reason for that, like I said, I thought probably 10 other times that it was the last one, but this really is the last one. I did a cumulative index that incorporated all 12 volumes, and that was to communicate that this really is the last one. Mm-hmm. Because if I go back now, if I put out a 13th volume, I would have to update that index, and that's more work than I plan to do ever.
Okay.
Because it's a 62-page cumulative index.
Wow.
So, yeah, that came out as its own separate book. So I won't do that, but I don't know what I'll do. You know, I've spent the last, since 1983, the Trapdoor for 15 years, and then I did the semi-automatic cartridge series for 27 years. And so now I think I'm enjoying catching up the reading, learning a little bit about magic history, and waiting for which project of mine that is out there that's going to bring it, rise up, and interest me enough to tackle it.
And now you're retired. You're going to be performing a little bit as well?
You know,
are you kind of like semi-retired and not going to be doing anything for anybody except yourself and conventions?
Now, before I do anything, I make sure I really want to do it.
Me too.
You know, yeah, exactly.
You have to have a passion for it.
It's a great place to be. But I was like that for a lot of my career. If somebody asked me to do something that I didn't want to do, you know, and they were going to book me for it, I would give them a name of somebody who would do, I think, a better job of it.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's really, do I want to go to all the trouble of putting together back an official act? No. I think I'll continue to do it for friends at parties and, you know, and I'll continue to write and create because I enjoy that. But, you know, what it'll end up, you know, will I publish something else? I'm pretty sure I will, but I don't know what. I'm too young to die. You know, I'm retired. I'm not dead, but I'll see what do I think I can do better than maybe somebody else could do. And then maybe that'll be the approach. Tackle
cool.
that. What needs to be done?
Well, now, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word Podcast, and I always like to close by asking my guests what it is that their philosophy of life, what is your magic word or phrase? What's important to you? What do you live by?
You know, you could have let me know that beforehand. Let's see. I maybe have two of them. Yeah, how about there are two kinds of people in the world. There are those who already have a playing card and those who need to select one. So that kind of gives us where we need to head.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll probably just, oh, well, yeah, yeah. If people really wanted to see card tricks, we wouldn't have to have 202 methods of forcing them.
Yeah.
So keep those in mind. And I think we've got kind of an open pathway. I don't spend a lot of time on what I think in deep thoughts. It's basically, what do I learn? What's practical? And what can I convey to others that'll help?
Yeah. I always say there are three types of people in the world, those who can count and those who can't.
So, and as an accountant, I appreciate that.
Yeah. Exactly. Steve, it's been wonderful. Thanks a lot. It's been great catching up over here. And it's been too long that to being able to spend this kind of time together, because I know whenever that we are at the convention that you are busy trying to think of some new material and kind of running about and everything.
And you're busy as well.
So, well, that's true.
You're busy running around doing the podcast.
With the microphone.
Yeah, and we usually get, you know, here, Steve, in 30 seconds, tell us your philosophy of magic.
Yeah.
You know?
Go back and listen to those snippets. Those are some gems.
Yeah, well, you do a great job, and I really enjoy it. I really do. I seldom get all the way from start to finish, but it's because I do it like I take the advantage of the downtime, like when I'm walking the dog. And I mean that in a complimentary way. I do audiobooks, and I love magic podcasts, and you do a terrific job. So, you're actually doing, I think, a service because you're documenting this time and this place now in magic.
at a moment in time, and it moves so quickly as well. And I've been doing this for, well, 9 years now. And so
Wow. Going
kind of going back and looking at some of the people, and whenever I have talked with them and saying, where do you see yourself 5 years from now, I can actually play that and go back and say, okay, well, maybe they are or they're not where they thought they were. Of course, people's plans change and for the future and everything then too. But the point is that it's been going on long enough that way. And so, yeah, I know that a lot of people listen when they're out walking their dog or they're at the gym working out, or whether that they're drive time, because it's about the perfect amount of time to listen during that commute to or from work or whatever. So, yeah, one guy said, I mean, this is a compliment, but you put me to sleep at night. And I said, what?
Yeah.
He said, I listen to you before I go to bed. And he said, just listening to your voice. And he said, about 15 minutes, I'm out. And I'll listen to some more the next night or whatever.
That's great. Hey, I'll give that a try. No, that's great. Yeah, well, at least they're not reading my books to do it. So thank you for that. You could have phrased that a whole lot differently.
That's right. Hey, and now leave then that last thing. What is your website if people are interested in wanting to order that or any of your other books?
By all means, stevebeam.com. Very simple.
Great. Thank you very much. I appreciate that, Steve. You've been a wonderful guest over here, and a lot of interesting information that you've shared with the rest of the listeners this way. They can go back and kind of listen about perhaps how they can fine-tune their funny.
I always enjoy talking with you, Scott. Take care.
Pleasure. Till next time, that was Steve Beam. This is Scotty out. Well, that was another fine podcast that you've gotten us into there, Stephen. Thank you very much for your kind comments and for getting together with me. I know that you've been very busy, even though that now you're in retirement and have a little bit more time. So I appreciate you spending some with me and also with the listeners and imparting some of that knowledge and wisdom. And so I want to remind everybody, by the way, in order to keep up with what's going on from week to week, to be sure to subscribe to our weekly pod letter. All you have to do is go to themagicwordpodcast.com. There you can find a way where that you can subscribe and find out what's going on from week to week and who's going to be on this week and who's coming up next week and some suggestions from the archives. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember these three things. What can I learn? What's practical? And what can I convey to others that will help them? This is Scotty out.